Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, on an evening when having a programme about anything other than the virus is a bit like asking the widow where the toilet is. It suggests your priorities are odd and your manners bad, but yet she's pretty likely to know. And we believe in culture. It's there in the title. So let's take a chance. Coming up this week, the American artist who thinks we need to live more in body time. We open Beethoven's Irish songbook, plus a host of golden daffodils in the choreography of Ed Shelton. But first, a model existence. Writer and assembler of handmade plaster objects, Sarah Bohm is a maker whose desire to create moves regularly between words and objects in the world. Bohm untangles this movement in her new book, Handiwork, a short exposition on life, love, and the process of making. It's a book about model railways and migratory birds, the pleasures of carving plaster, and the legacy of mending, and what happens when life, art, and storytelling are integrated so deeply that you can no longer feel the seams. Culture File's Eleanor Flegg went to visit Sarah Bohm in the artist's model-stuffed house near Skibbereen.
By the time the trip was almost over, in August, in the train station of a small city in western Germany, I was still capable of being charmed by the model railway. The persistent memory which defines that summer is the shadow of my standing self cast across the static landscape. A cloud passing over a miniature universe, a perfect universe, protected from contamination. Yeah, does it make a little scraping noise? This is carving plaster. Most of the stuff I've made over the past year or so is carved plaster. I set it first. I talk about this in Handiwork. It's just modelling plaster. You buy it as powder, and then it goes back into powder, which I always think is kind of poetic. But in between, it gets mixed and cast in the sort of plastic vessels that the packaging that you get from supermarkets, basically. I keep all of that, and I use it to make different moulds. And then when it's set, you turn out the mould. And break it up again, and then carve it down into whatever shape you want. There is, I realised, no sky in a model railway. In the hobby shop, on the rack which displays the landscaping materials, amongst the packets of seafoam trees and miscellaneous hedging, tarmac and ballast scatters, grass flocks and rolls of spring green mats, and summer and autumn and winter green mats, there has never been, on the market, right up until this present moment, a fabric available for the replication of firmament. At the moment, the longer project that I'm working on at the moment, and I can show you them upstairs if you want, are container ships. So they're all, I mean, the hull is just kind of a long, even shape, and then all of the containers are just small rectangles. I cast them out of matchboxes because I like the idea that you're kind of creating a replica of the largest kind of container from the smallest kind of container. So that's mainly what I'm doing at the moment. With my little saw.
Did you see that thread?
These are some of the birds that are photographed for Handiwork. I have them out because I'm photographing them again.
They are birds of great character. Look at the pigeon, the expression on its face.
I mean, I'm glad you can see that's a pigeon, because to me it looks slightly gormless, which is what pigeons look like.
They're also on sticks, like lollipops.
Yeah, I put a lot of things. I just love dowel, which are like thin wooden rods. There's something about wood plaster fabric, sort of they're my go-to materials. So I always have the bits of dowel knocking around, and it just made sense to put them on sticks. In model shops, you'll get birds that are perching on things, but then you also get birds that are on little sticks to sort of give the impression that they're hovering above things. So that was kind of where the concept came from. This is the room where everything goes to die, as I say. But, well, I guess it's both the beginning and the end, because there's various different materials. But then there's also, once everything has been finished, it's where everything comes back and gets put away. And all of these boxes came back from the exhibition I had in London at the end of 2018. Well, that gives you a good idea of the carved plaster. Lots of carved plaster.
Are they about 100 tiny white plaster houses?
That's a very good visual counting, or whatever you call it. Yeah, there's exactly 100. And they're each houses, but they began... The idea in my head was to create a kind of replica of the Irish cottage souvenir, this souvenir. Souvenirs is something that I kind of extrapolate from quite a lot. And even though it's lots of small pieces and lots of effort, it doesn't actually take up that much space on a wall.
Were you not tempted to paint it? Because the barges, or the container ships, they're amazing. They kind of look like children's toys.
Yeah, no, everything I make looks like children's toys. And I think this has been a great obstacle to me in my career as a visual artist.
Do the barges have a destination?
No, and you know, I mean, it's a good question, but to be honest, I don't think about the objects in that way. I do end up, because you spend so long working on them, you end up coming up with ideas for them, you know, academic ideas for them, and I end up reading things that, I mean, this is really what handiwork is. It was the book that grew out of all the time I spent thinking and reading around, you know, the subject of the stuff I was making. But what came first was the making, you know, it was simply my desire to get away from language and all of its constraints, and to just do something because I was concerned with colour and form and shape. So for me, it's the objects don't really mean anything, really. They do eventually, but at the beginning, it's just I want to make a certain thing because I can picture it and I want to see it as an object in the world. I love the colours, for example, that come up in the containers. You know, they're always sort of rusty browns or blues or orange. For me, it's a purely... It's an obsession with the thing as an object and not really what it means or where it's going. Cookie dog snoring again.
Sarah Boehm talking to Eleanor Flegg there, and Handiwork by Sarah Boehm is published by Tramp Press and in bookshops from the 25th of March. And have a look at Culturefile on Instagram for images of the models mentioned in this file. It's the Paddy's Day that never was, when Ludwig van Beethoven voyaged to the land that inspired and provided the tunes for his greatest songs. Beethoven, as it happens, never enjoyed Paddy's Day in Ireland, but he did create a great trove of song settings, and though it's not always acknowledged, many of them were settings of Irish traditional melodies. The words, well, they were a different matter altogether. Margaret O'Sullivan Farrell, who edited the first complete collection of Beethoven's Irish settings, takes up the story.
Oh, would I were but that sweet minute that I had my apple tree too, that I had my apple tree too.
One person, Alice Hofstadter Anderson, called them an obedient supply of Hibernian absurdities. So that was very critical. Another scholar, Una Hunt, the Thomas More scholar, thought they were actually German poetry translated into English. And that's why they sounded so strange. I'm Margaret O'Sullivan Farrell, and I'm the editor of a recent collection of all of Beethoven's settings of Irish folk songs. This is a slightly different edition in that all the songs have been retexted by Tomás O'Sullivan. Tomás loved the Beethoven's Irish folk song settings and realised that there were very little was known about them, even among Irish people, and wondered why. And he came to the conclusion that the problem was, and he wasn't the only one who thought this, that the problem was that the texts that were appended to the songs after Beethoven arranged them were all very antiquated and not by great poets, so it wasn't great poetry, and that some of the words, in fact, were very trite. You know, they're full of Dermots and Sheilas, and they live in cabins in the woods and this kind of thing. Quite stage Irishy, really. What happened was Beethoven arranged the songs for the publisher George Thompson, who was an Edinburgh publisher, who asked him to do them. Thompson sent the ears to Beethoven. Beethoven arranged them and sent them back, all by post. Thompson would then set about appending text to the words, in other words. For this, he originally hoped and believed that the poet Robert Burns would supply the words, because actually it was Robert Burns' idea for Thompson to do the Irish ones in the first place. So by the time he had engaged Beethoven and done all the negotiations about money, etc., unfortunately Robert Burns had died. He died in 1796. He had a problem then. He had no words by Robert Burns. So he then tried to interest Thomas More, the Irish poet Thomas More, in providing the words, which would have been wonderful. So he sent Thomas More lots of melodies, and Thomas More took 2 years to answer him and then decided not to. He decided to go off with another publisher himself, which was very clever of him, because he probably realised Beethoven would get all the credit for the compositions. So he went with a different publisher. So poor Thompson then had no poet. Burns had died. Thomas More didn't want to do it. So he then had to engage other lesser known poets. So the words, to say the least, are a little bit antiquated and odd. Then wondered, would some publisher take on the task of putting Moore's words back onto these melodies? A lot of the melodies that Moore and Thompson sent to Beethoven were actually the same tunes. So obviously a lot of the words that Moore put to the poetry would suit these ones as well, if it was just transferred back. It was a long labour of love over 20 or 30 years. I just helped do the editing and putting the words to the music, the computer stuff, which he didn't do, he did it all by hand. But he chose all the texts, and it just all came together.
When we think of Beethoven and arranging music, you think of big scores, symphony orchestras. Aligning that with traditional Irish music just seems kind of strange. What kind of arrangements are we talking about here?
Thompson asked for arrangements for piano with optional violin and cello. Now, Beethoven kind of fought against this for a while. He wanted to make the violin and cello complete, obbligato, but Thompson was insistent he wanted them to be played with just piano alone. So that's what Beethoven did. So they're all completely and utterly performable with piano, but there's violin and cello part as well. So they're trio, piano trios as well, piano trio and voice. You know, it seems from the correspondence with Thompson that he actually quite liked them and liked the job. It was just a job for him, of course. But they're lovely in that there's a little ritornello at the beginning and the end. And also he introduced a little thing, a little cadenzas for the voice, usually just before the last phrase. So they're quite small scale, beautiful little miniatures, really.
For this kind of a job, would Beethoven have done his research in terms of trying to find out as much about Irish folk music as he could and using the kind of folk inflections in his arrangements, or would it have been much more blind than that?
I think it was probably much more blind than that, yes. I think Beethoven probably had no idea where Ireland was at all. And it's doubtful if he even knew where England or Scotland were either. He didn't speak English, and Thompson, funny enough, didn't speak German, so they corresponded in French, very bad French. The most recent performance of the songs actually was a lovely event. It was for the 250th anniversary of the Historical Society in Trinity, the HIST. By a lovely coincidence, Beethoven's birthday was the same year as the HIST. And also the other connection was, of course, that Thomas More was a member of the HIST, as was John Philpot Curran, whose words we've used as well. And also, of course, poor Robert Emmet, who was executed and who one of the songs is about, O Breathe Not His Name.
I mean, it's a magic combination. It's so strange that these managed to fall under the woodwork for so long.
Indeed, absolutely. And people are amazed when they hear them, you know, and they seem so fresh. In one aspect, I suppose, they suffered because traditional people thought the accompaniments weren't traditional, so they kind of rejected them. And then classical people said, oh, it's only folk songs, it's only folk music. So it's really funny. It kind of fell, maybe they fell between the steps, I don't know. But hopefully now they'll be popularised. This was Thomas O'Sullivan's wish, fervent wish, that they would simply be sung more. I think my favourite is a duet, actually. It's called Farewell. Well, the Moore's words on it are Farewell, but whenever you welcome the hour. So that's a real beauty. I think if I died and went to heaven, this is what I'd like the angels to be singing.
Margaret O'Sullivan Farrell there, editor of Beethoven's Irish Songs Revisited. Ornya Gallagher was the reporter. It's pretty interesting to listen to people recorded in the distant past of, say, last week, in that other world with other concerns, and notice all the same how they seem to be addressing our new place. Take this conversation recorded with Chicago-based textile artist Anne Wilson at the recent Make Symposium in Cork. Wilson makes drawings using human hair and found thread to explore time, loss, social and private rituals. In parallel, she also makes performance works, allowing her and her collaborators to think about what she calls body time, the time we spend often on our own, performing simple tasks that can get lost in the fog of busyness.
My name is Anne Wilson. My art practice for the last 10 years has really moved between a more traditional studio practice with these material drawings and performances where the work only exists in the period of time in which it's performed. The kind of crisis of production in the United States, with so many of the factories closing and moving offshore, for many artists and textiles creates an arena to consider who makes what we wear, how are they made, how are they paid, what are the injustices around historically and in contemporary moment of labor. And so my moving the work outside of the studio into more public space and working with people to take on some of the issues of making a textile, to perhaps expose the strain on the body of repetitive labor, to show and participate as a group our own stretching as part of the choreography of the performance, the durational aspect of the performance, to expose the means of production as a meditation on the subject of making itself. I think it's important for us as human beings living in the bodies we still live in to acknowledge what I'm calling body time, the time it takes to comb your hair, to brush your teeth, to walk from one place to another, to cook a slow meal, to stitch, hand stitch a piece of cloth, to recognize that kind of time and the time it takes for self-care, for greater awareness of what life can be, what life can bring. I think there's a number of reasons why that kind of body time and acknowledgement of our bodies in space is valid and valuable in relation perhaps to the pace of a faster digital speed. I've taught a class for many years at the School of the Art Institute called Time, Material, and the Everyday. And we often start as an exercise by making drawings of these slow body time processes, not a picture of oneself brushing one's teeth, but a picture of the motion of that motion. That assignment results in all kinds of curious, often energy-filled, sort of intensive linear work, because we're working generally with lines, various kinds of media, drawing lines and various kinds of substrates. There is a great interest in performance art. And so moving between physical making and then working with one's body, and these same exercises are valuable in that regard. Seeing students turn to a re-engagement with material, the first and foremost, I think, is really just the saturation of the digital, the saturation of screens. We're in a screen culture where more and more the things that you do just for everyday life is sitting in front of a computer screen. So this want for direct sensorial experience, the want for direct tactile, more immersive tactile haptic experience, that sense of touch, it feels like a basic human
want. And I think that's also very evident in a lot of the global art fairs and art exhibitions, that so many artists are rethinking their own histories of craft, their own histories of cultural making, and bringing that to the fore. Much of that work is very political around identities and injustice. I see in the art world a greater acknowledgement, appreciation, and sensitivity to greater diversity of making, including craft processes and textile processes, particularly with the wonderful work that's becoming more visible from non-Western cultures, artists from Turkey, India, various Asian countries, Africa, drawing upon cultural traditions of making that have always held deep cultural value, if not spiritual value, certainly deep aesthetic value, and incredible skill, bringing that into the contemporary art realm, sort of debunking the Western canon's problem with making, you know, and hand making, and the denigration of hand making, often, particularly if it's textile, to the work of women in domestic environments.
Artist Anne Wilson there, and the reporter was Rachel Andrews. And if you find yourself with an idle minute, you can see more of her work at annewilsonartist.com. Easily the most watchable program on TV right now is The Weather. Rain or shine, just the update that it's blandly happening is deeply soothing, because out there it certainly is spring, and out there lolling in pots, poking through railings, waving are the daffodils, which gives us an opportunity to hear again from one of our all-time favourite daffodil pickers. Ed Shelton is a Dutch-born artist who once upon a time lived in Ireland. Initially he was dancing with Dogda Dance Company in Limerick, but soon, as we'll now hear, he'd begun creating a unique kind of choreography on a Waterford daffodil farm.
I was born in smack bang in the center of the Bulb district in the Netherlands. And I, never had any experience with bulbs or tulips, daffodils, any kind of flowers like that. I was working, when I was at Dagda, I was working on the milk market every Saturday. And a friend of mine who has a shop there called me one day, said, somebody needs a hand tomorrow, do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, great. So I got to the market, literally Adam gave me a list of the flowers to sell, gave me the boxes of flowers and said, here, just, there's the prices, there's the flowers. And I had no idea what an amaryllis was or chrysanthemum was or all of those things. I had absolutely no idea. And there I was standing, this Dutch boy from the Bulb district, without any idea. A lot of these flowers are actually coming from my hometown. So it was really funny that I then ended up a couple of months after that in the middle of the Bulb district of Ireland. Also considering that a lot of Irish people in the 70s especially went over to Holland to pick flowers and to work in the bulb industry there. I first went to the farm to pick and to investigate my artistic practice, and which is, investigating movement, space, and time. And I wanted to take that out of the theater space, out of the gallery space, out of the artistic bubble, and place it into a completely different situation. So I performed flower picking for 6 weeks, which was basically me embedding myself as a flower picker, not just working in the fields as a picker, but also performing the picking, which is nothing more than working as a picker, really, but with the intention of performing. In the arts bubble, you are constantly spending your energy acquiring subsidies, networking in order to be seen. You spend a lot of time not making the work because you need to fund the work. And by going to the farm, my act of picking the flowers was also a way to subsidize the work directly. So I, from my perspective, I was performing the picking, and I was getting paid to perform the picking. Of course, from the farmer's point of view, he was paying me for, 80 or 800 bunches of daffodils that I would pick. I think from the outside, it wouldn't look that different. But I did prepare differently. I would warm up as a dancer would, or as a dancer might before a performance. So I would warm up in the morning before going out into the field. And I would also make a conscious choice or decision to step into the space, into the picking space or into the field space. And then while I was picking, I would keep my attention on the moment. I would try to suspend the moment instead of thinking about the future, about the past, which were quite present because you are leaving flowers behind you as you pick. So you have a real sense of what you've done as you go through the row of daffodils. And you also have a real sense of what you're still going to do. But I try to really stay concentrated on the moment and experience the space and experience the time that I was spending there in the movement, the repetitive movement. Into the field with a group of other pickers, and generally a drill or a row of daffodils that could keep you occupied for an entire day. So you're only picking that one line, and so you really get a sense of what you leave behind, because you pick the flowers, you bundle them, and then you leave them behind you. When you stand up and look ahead, you see what is still ahead of you. And of course, that fades out as you look further. Just as when you look back, you can see what's directly behind you as a vivid memory. And as you look further back, the memory fades a bit. You can't quite see what you've done back there. At the end of the day, what you're really doing is you're picking one flower at a time. And this was my intention, to really try to stay focused with that one flower, even though you might pick, on a very good day, you might pick 10,000 flowers. So you're literally snapping, because you snap them off. You don't actually cut them, you snap them. So you're actually snapping about 10,000 flowers. Now, I would say that maybe 8,000 would be more average, but still a great amount to consider that you would do if you want to pick each flower as an individual flower. And that repetitive movement, that repetitive motion of snapping the flower, the stem, it concentrates all of your thoughts into that one moment. That's what I was trying to do. So stay focused on that one flower at a time. There's a rhythm of it, and that repetitive movement brings you into a bit of a flow. And when you're really lucky, you suspend that moment, and you really. It's almost like the whole space and time is enhanced, and you're hanging above yourself, and you really hear that the crispness of the snap of the flower, and you see the slow motion of maybe the sap that's spraying out from where the cut is made, and so you really have a sense of being in the moment, and it's obviously very brief, and yet it feels like, I wouldn't say an eternity, but it feels much bigger than what you might consider a moment to be.
A host of daffodils there, and in their midst, Ed Shelton. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more heartening buds next Friday at 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.